Well, guten Morgen. Yeah. Okay. Nice to see you again. Nice that you're not having to stand so much this morning as last night. At any rate, I'm very glad to see you here this morning. What I would like to consider this morning is this. It'll be in a two-part mode. The transition of emphasis on church music, or the development of church music, the transition from Italy to Germany, obviously due in to a great degree to the Reformation. There are other reasons for that shift in emphasis, and of course it would go beyond the dimensions of our time and probably our interests too to consider a number of those different things, but I would like to fill you in on some of the background that made that transition, that shift, possible. What we have to thank, our debt of gratitude, you know, to certain composers and certain events and so on, in that whole transaction. Now, I have a watch here, and so I'm going to try to round things off for chapel this morning at a reasonable time. More or less, I'll just have to break off wherever I break off, and then we will resume then at 10 o'clock. I have given you the outline of our considerations here on the board. These are the four areas that, in my estimation, would be important to consider. The influence of the hymn, I'll do that very, very briefly because you've been hearing a number of things and you will hear a number of other things from Robin Lever on this, so that's not necessary for me to cover that in such detail, but that is one of the primary avenues of change. The second one is Lassus and the so-called Munich School. Now, I don't know whether anybody else calls it the Munich School besides yours truly, but there was an important little school of protégés of Orlando di Lasso who studied under this great Catholic music master, Dutch birth, that served so long in Italy, and of course world famous. There were these three young composers who were strongly influenced by Lassus. And we will talk about these three because they turned out to be Protestants. And they went out into, so to say, all of the Protestant-speaking world, Germany, and spread that spirit of composition, a rather interesting area that usually gets omitted. Then two areas that most of you have probably heard the most about, and those are the two visits of Heinrich Schütz to Venice and to Italy. The first visit, 1609-1612, as protege of Giovanni Gabrieli, the great polyphonic writer. And that school of composers at that time were composing under the prima pratica, the first practice, or the, so to say, the old way of writing, as it was probably later then called. And that was more this polyphonic sort of block harmony sort of a style. It was still polyphonic, but there were lots of these sturdy harmonies that you will hear in a recording in a few minutes. And then finally, the second visit of Heinrich Schütz to Italy. Now there he came under the influence of Viadana, who was the person probably most responsible for the invention of the basso continuo technique, at least in church music. The influence of the Camerata, and Monteverdi, the great composer, Schütz was under his influence very much in his second visit in 1628-29. And The reason we mentioned Schutz at this point was, of course, that Schutz was influenced greatly by those two visits to Italy, and as a Protestant, as a Lutheran, brought back to Germany those ways of composing, besides the adding of his own great artistry and so on. So that is it in a nutshell. So let's begin. The first will be the influence of the hymn. The hymn emerged back in the 16th century as controversial medium of congregational involvement in the liturgies of the new Lutheran Church, and was much more than a convenient adornment for a church service. In many cases, it was an avenue for social, political expression, or even a vehicle for ecclesiastical polemics. One needs only to think of Luther's Erhalt uns Herr bei deinem Wort, Lord, keep us steadfast in your word and curb the Turks and Papists' murderings. Okay, now that's a hymn, right? We, of course, sing a slightly different set of words to that today, and one of those sets will be in this little Praetorius collection that, courtesy of Rodney Schrank and Concordia Publishing House, we will be singing through this morning. And by the way, you're welcome to keep those. That's a little gift from Concordia Publishing House. Now, the hymn was a proven component of church musical composition, one that caused listeners to relate a given piece to the very foundation of Protestant faith. And that foundation had to do with overt singing about faith on the part of the laity, or at least an active listening to such vernacular expressions by the choir. Here we have thousands of hymns being written and endless numbers of motets and other compositions based on those hymns. These hymns and compositions revolutionized the liturgy of the Mass and attracted countless people to the Lutheran cause, to Germany, and to liturgical art forms that played a role in changing, stabilizing, and nourishing lives. Now, I shall return to the hymn again a little bit later, but would like now to turn to one of the neglected fields of influence and development in this transition. This will already be point number two, from Catholicism to Protestantism, essentially. And this moment took place under the great Dutch Catholic who spent so much time in Italy, Orlando di Lasso. For a substantial period of his career, he served in the Bavarian courts of Munich and Landshut. You see here on this very artistic map, you see here Munich, Landshut. And during the third quarter of the 16th century, three important young composers who became very important composers of Protestant church music were his protégés. These were Leonhard Lechner, L-E-C-H-N-E-R, Johannes Eckardt, E-C-C-A-R-D, and Joachim A. Burg, B-U-R-G-K, sometimes spelled differently, never mind. These carried out Lasso's ideals toward word-inspired compositions and the musica reservata, and propagated them practically all over Germany. Now, the first of these that we'll consider briefly is Johannes Eckardt, born 1553 in Mühlhausen, died 1611 in Berlin. You see up at the very, very top of the map. Some of his training was under Joachim A. Burg. Eckardt was a Sängerknabe, a choir boy for the Weimar Hof in 1567 to 71. 1571 to 73, he was a singer and a disciple of Lassus in Munich. After that, he went to Augsburg. And then for many, many years, Eckardt gradually became Kapellmeister in Königsberg. Now, he received much attention, probably more attention than any of the other three here, during the 19th century, as many of his compositions, especially the slow-moving ones, fulfilled the ideals of the, quote, true church music, unquote, of the Enlightenment movement and of the Sicilian movement, being called sort of a German Palestrina, if you will. So if you look in choral catalogs, you'll probably find his name more often mentioned than any of the other two of this little school. The second one of the three, Joachim A. Burg, was born 1546, in Burg, but then B-U-R-G, which of course is there's an obvious takeoff there on that name, which is near Magdeburg. Burg died 1610 in Mühlhausen. He served many, many years at St. Blasius. In Mühlhausen had become, in 1557, Protestant. So he arrived in Mühlhausen not very many years after this turnover had taken place, which meant that he essentially had to set up the new church music. I mean, if you could imagine, if you would be serving in a place that was totally Roman Catholic, and now all these ideals of the Lutheran Reformation, now you have to change everything, develop things, and so on. Now, it's not absolutely certain, I would want to point out, it's not absolutely certain that Burg was personally with Lassus. I think he was, but I can't prove that. But at least he was strongly under the influence of Lassus, as you can see in many of his compositions. At any rate, we do know that he was for some time with Johannes Eckard. So Burg was nearly 50 years as music director and Protestant church music composer in Mühlhausen. Of course, we know Mühlhausen from our friend Johann Sebastian. All right, the third, and for my purposes, the most important of these three composers was Leonhard Leschner. At this point, I would like to insert a brief section on Leschner and his life and deal somewhat with his all-choral, through-composed Passion setting of 1593 in the context of the history of Passion settings and of Protestant Lutheran church music developments. And I present Leschner and also his Passion as a model that, you know, in some senses could stand as an example or as a in the place of quite a number of other compositions. So, Leonhard Leschner, born 1553 in Etchtal, South Tyrol. You can see that just below Austria here. This area right here is where this little valley is, Etchtal, you know, which was a German-speaking area now in northern Italy, about 75 miles south of Innsbruck, Austria. He most likely gathered his early musical training as a choir boy from various church choir situations in smaller and larger cities in the area, cities such as Bolzano, Merano, and Trento. The valley of the River Etch was in itself not one of the great music centers of that day, but nonetheless, the Latin school in Bolzano was called the singing school during the 15th and 16th centuries. By the time Leschner had reached the age of 17, he had already been choir boy and apprentice under Orlando di Lasso in the Bavarian courts in Munich and Landshut, through Austria and up here to Munich and Landshut. He held Lasso in the highest esteem, and Lasso and Duke Wilhelm V wrote fine letters of recommendation for him at his time of departure. Financial problems of the court surely led to his leaving. Now, I hope you're understanding that I'm presenting Leschner a bit as a model of some of those composers that went through this shift, if you will. Now, about the same time, two other German composers, as I mentioned before, were learning from Lassus, Bork, and Eckhart. And they, of course, influenced Protestant church music very much. Because you remember that I mentioned that they were going into places like Mühlhausen, Stuttgart. You can just see how this movement from these three composers was enormously important. Lasso, an interesting thing with Lasso is not just that he was interested in texts and word-inspired compositions. Lasso was also one who pioneered the cause of setting more gospel texts to music. Sort of an interesting little point. Lechner then traveled and gathered experience from other great masters during the years 1570 to 75, and he must have spent much of this time in Italy, since his extraordinary command of the Italian language and style of musical composition already is evidenced in his earliest works. Of course, I would want to point out here that these distances are not very great, according to American standards at least. But of course, if you have to go on foot across the Alps, that's a bit of a task too. It might slow you down a little bit, down to low gear. During these 5 years of, let's say, learning from here, there, and everywhere, an important change took place in his personal life. He decided to leave the Catholic Church in order to become a dedicated Protestant. The implications of such a decision for a musician at that time who depended upon the favor of some church or nobleman for a livelihood were certainly great. And when he was 22 years of age, 1575, ripe old age, he went to Nuremberg, see here, to take the lowly position as a school teacher. Nothing against school teaching, but when you think of the noble things that he was doing otherwise. He married in 1576 and henceforth thought of himself as a Nuremberger. By 1577, he was recognized there as an extraordinary musician and composer. And indeed, many of his manuscripts are still in that area, various libraries. In the years following, there was a constant friction between the Calvinists, the Philippists, and the Lutherans. And as he turned 30, 1583, he was able to use his earlier letter of recommendation to acquire the position of Hofkapellmeister under Count Eitel Friedrich von Hohenzollern in Hechingen, which is over here, not too far from Tübingen, southwest of Stuttgart a ways. There was, however, one drawback in this situation for him. Not only were the Hohenzollerns Catholic, but the Count was an active propagator of the Counter-Reformation. And so after 1 year, Lechner fled, probably for religious reasons. There must have existed a close cooperation, however, between the court of Hechingen and Bavaria, Munich. Not only did Lasso write some of the music for Hechingen during Lechner's time of office, but upon Lechner's departure, Orlando's brother, Ferdinand, took his place. See, it's an absolute network of connections and relationships here. In 1585, Lechner started in the humble position of tenor singer in the Protestant court of Württemberg, Stuttgart, under Duke Ludwig, and under the Hofkapellmeister Ludwig Daser, D-A-S-E-R. In the next year, Lechner became court composer, in 1595, Hofkapellmeister. And the honor which Lechner and his musicians brought to the court can be documented by many sources. And in spite of his decisive Lutheran faith, he had a good working relationship with Catholic musicians, and he performed some of their works and even sent some of his young musicians to Catholic courts in Austria and Italy for further training. Right. Now, during those final 18 years of his life in Stuttgart, he suffered much illness, but in spite of this, it was his finest period of creativity. sort of knocks Maslow's little pyramid in pieces a bit. Two fine examples from that period are his Passion of 1593 and the German madrigal collection, the sayings of the Sprüche of from Tod und Leben. And he was able to compose really some remarkable music. And he was not only a fine composer, but a person of integrity and constancy. And it was also said of him that he was well-versed in matters of religion and faith. He was buried with great honor in the Hospitalkirche in Stuttgart. And now, just for a moment, let's consider the Passion, or the Passion settings, in general, and the development of that as a musical form, because that also has to do with this development of the, or let's say this transaction in this shift from Italy to Germany. I've put a few terms on the board of the several types that I would want to consider here. This does not take us as far as Bach. The first category of passion setting would be the plain song passion. And this allows for simply a more dramatic rendering of the story than simple Bible, recited Bible verse. And in order to differentiate between the persons in the story, it was customary to have the singers sing at different pitch levels and usually at different speeds. The evangelist, for example, the narrator, would sing at a medium speed and a medium pitch level, usually reciting on C, middle C for a tenor, middle C, and extending down to F. And the words of Christ would be at a lower pitch and a slower speed, reciting on F and extending down to the C below middle C. And the words of the Jews and the other characters in the Passion story at a higher pitch and faster speed, reciting on high F and extending down to C. Now this practice, along with the use of the fifth mode, F, was called the passion tone. And the melodic characteristics of the F mode were thought of as being appropriate for passion composition at least as far back as the 13th and 14th century. So this was, goes back quite far. The second major category is called under various names. Maybe there are even more than the ones I've mentioned here. The polyphonic passion, or the dramatic, responsorial, or scenic passion. It's all titled essentially for the same thing. Musicologists quarrel about that to a degree. Now, here, only the words of the evangelist and Christ are sung in chant, and all others are incorporated into the polyphonic sections. And this practice dates back at least to about 1450. The next category, the German Passion of the Reformation, this led to an adaptation of the vernacular and occasionally to modifications in the traditional plain song. For example, the use of an elaborate melisma for Jesus' outcry of Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. The earliest passion of this type, Johann Walter, St. Matthew Passion, 1550, was very popular and was still performed quite frequently in such places as Nuremberg as late as 1806, and of course has been revived since that time in various places. The next stage that I want to mention here would be the through-composed figural, motet, or choral, or even chorale passion. And all the words of the text are polyphonically set, that is, it's composed entirely for choir. In addition, the text was usually a composite of the four gospel accounts of the Passion story. And this practice, called Evangelion Harmonie, which means a harmony of the gospels, was probably motivated by Luther's statement that said, sing all four gospels. It would be more appropriate, however, to refer to this practice as a Passions Harmonie rather than Evangelion Harmonie, since it has to do precisely with those parts of the Gospels dealing with the passion story. And the main flow of compositions in this form came from back from the second half of the 16th century, Villard, Bourg, Gallos, and then Lechner. And their original model was an early passion setting by Longueval in about 1510, formally attributed to Obrecht. And in that old passion, in fact, so far, they're also included text from all four passions. Now, Lechner's passion, I'd like to consider that just for a few minutes here. And how is it unique, considering that he is Protestant and so on? Lechner's immediate prototype was probably Ludwig Dasor. His through composed Latin Passion in Stuttgart, 1578. Dasor was Lechner's predecessor as Hofkapellmeister in Stuttgart, but interestingly enough, Dasor was also the predecessor of Lassus in Munich. And figure that one out. Right? And he was also a well-known Lutheran composer. Well, whatever. Several elements make this passion unique. It was not uncommon that a chorale melody would be employed in such a composition, but here it is emphasized in the form of the old Latin church chorale, the old traditional passion tone. It was unique in that the principles of the passion tone would be consistently yet freely used in a through-composed passion. In the moment Lechner chose to use the passion tone, he identified himself with liturgical tradition, but then utilized it all the more freely. So it was really his own way of doing it. All style elements are applied, even to the extent of word painting, in order to make the story of Christ's suffering easy to remember. Now, his choice of text. Now, the main text is taken from the Gospel of John, but portions from all four Gospels are employed, and care was taken to include all seven words of Christ on the cross. It is also quite possible that his friend, the Nuremberger court pastor, Osiander, could have advised him in the choice of text, and Osiander himself exercised considerable influence on Protestant church music through his 50 spiritual songs and psalms. Nuremberg, 1586. The editing and reducing of the text do seem to be Lechner's own work, so to say, a personal moment in faith, if you will. Certainly, all phrases and verses not contributing directly to the drama of the story are omitted, and the references outside of John's Gospel are also only used in order to tell the story more effectively and heighten the drama. For example, adding that Peter went out and wept bitterly, or the verses that include the mocking of Christ on the cross. And then at the end of the Passion, we have a full setting of the old Latin chorale text, but then in German. Treatment of the text. The utter efficiency with which Lechner trimmed and organized the text demonstrates an eye for essentials, and the manner in which the texts are set is astoundingly effective. The words of Christ or other important sayings are not shortened at all, while the narrative is reduced to the extent that the completion of certain phrases is even left somewhat to the listener's imagination. So watch out for pedantry. You know, a lot of times we say everybody, they have to understand every single word or else. With Lechner, he took the words of Christ and other important sayings, set them broadly, and then other points of the narrative, he dealt with them in a dramatic, quick way, not sloppy, but nonetheless, he didn't hesitate to, so to say, let you in your mind sort of finish the phrase. Let me give you an example. Here we have, you can see the way here that in the denial narrative of Peter, the cock begins to crow before the preceding text comes to an end. Let me point it out to you. Here Peter is denying Christ, says, I am not, ich bin nicht, I am not a disciple. And notice here, and it says, and then just as soon as he did that, and you notice that that text doesn't quite come to a close, and already the cock is crowing, and it says here, and crowed, crayed, der Hahn. I think you'll be able to hear that a little bit. I'll play some of his setting in just a moment. Now, in counting the measures, of course they didn't have measures, but if you would make these artificial measures, in counting the measures in which the words of Christ appear, one can see the relationship percentage-wise to the words of the remaining text. So the number of measures, the total number of measures in the Lectio Passione, 584, and the number of measures in which the words of Christ appear, 148, which is over a fourth of the entire composition is taken up in the words of Christ. Now, in comparison, Heinrich Schütz's dramatically effective Johannes Passion, 1665, shows the following relationships. Out of a total number of measures, if you will, 747, 85 have words of Christ, which is only about one-ninth, about 11%. So, I mean, Fleischmann was he had a very strong concept here. So in other words, Schütz simply sets the John text in its entirety, and this, of course, does not degrade Schütz's Passion, but only demonstrates Lechner's efficiency regarding the points mentioned. Well, now, depending upon the situation, the Passion tone wandered from part to part, obeying it precisely at one point and merely hinting at it at others. And let me show you what I mean here. Here is the Passion tone. And you see it down here, shifting down to the tenor. And so on. And so sometimes it even overlaps with itself. But now let me play you just a little bit of that so that you can hear it. One consistent adherence to the Passion tone principle, which is in the punctus interrogativus, questioning, nearly always the melodic line rises at the close of a question. And you will hear that coming here. When Christ said, Wen suchet ihr? Whom seek you? There. Upward. So he is saying, Christ is saying, whom seek ye? So at the end of a question, the voice rises. Yes, please. In that sense that you have the high reciting line for the others, the crowd, the Jews, crucify him, etc. The mid-range, if you will, the evangelist's words around C down to F, in whichever voice range, but the principle was that going on all the time like that. Throughout his passion, this chorale passion. So even though you were singing four-part choir, these principles were being tossed about, you know, in a most elegant manner, you know, throughout. Yes. Yes, yes. So it is precisely that principle. Walter is, of course, not in a four-part setting like this, but that, yes, right. Yes. Then, once again, I would point out the part of that efficiency here. Look, please, that he wanted to get across the idea that Peter denied Christ three times. And you notice here the slower note values on I am not he, I am not he, and in the soprano broader note values, you know, I am not he. And so he lets these overlap, and so in a very concentrated way, he takes care of the three-time denial. Understand, but then when it comes to the words of Christ, he gives them more space. Of course, such an overlapping makes it very exciting too. So you say, you know, I am not he, I am not he, I am not he. No. So it happens very quickly. Then also then when Peter went out and wept bitterly, there is an unexpected cadence on C that's set up. It seems to lead nowhere, rather switches back to the F major harmony and resumes with the story. It's an amazing sensitivity in compositional technique. One last little thing about this would be the cross, the symbol of the cross that you find then, of course, in Bach's works many, many times when dealing with matters of the cross or the crucifixion. And here, here is one example where Jesus is being crucified, and we come to the words that says, and Jesus was between them, between the two thieves. And you see, if you draw a line from the what is here, the B down to this lower F, that would be a line this way. And then the lower B to the C would be a line this way, which would be a reclining cross. And that was the symbol, the so-called Kreuz symbol, cross symbol, used so often during that time and then also in the works of Bach. There have been entire books written about that subject. By the way, there was a book that I wanted to mention from the lecture the other day that I think it was Robin Lever, he was talking about books along this line. It's Vor deinen Thron trete ich hiermit. No, got the word order wrong. Vor deinen Thron trete ich hiermit, yeah. And it is a book by Ludwig Prouch, P-R-A-U-T, better spell it on the board. Has an extensive dealing with the symbolism in especially Bach's final works, just with an amazing amount of detail. Yeah. Well, and then also here, one last word to the Leschner thing. When references made to the two criminals being crucified next to Christ, and where the words occur, zu beiden Seiten, to each side, the soprano voice moves to the neighboring tone and back, and the neighboring tone and back again. You know, now you can say that doesn't necessarily make great music, and that's true. In the case of Lechner, he utilized, just as with Bach, he utilized these devices as a part of his great artistry. So in other words, employing the symbols doesn't make great art. But if a great artist takes them and utilizes them, it makes it all the more meaningful. That would be my point of view. Now let us consider the third and fourth areas of development in the transition from Italy to Germany. In the time between 1600 and 1750, the time we generally call the musical Baroque, we are confronted with the area of German church music, which encompasses not only development and change in music, but also in literature, philosophy, theology, and liturgy. At the heart of this exciting evolution is solo vocal music of the Italian Catholic, but increasingly the German Protestant Church. And the controversial beginnings of the Reformation and even the Counter-Reformation are gradually behind us, and the full force of both Reformation and Counter-Reformation are producing overwhelming results in church music. And the main influence here comes from Italy at St. Mark's during Heinrich Schütz's first visit as Giovanni Gabrieli's protege. And here we have the sturdy multi-choir compositional technique of the prima pratica, the first manner of practice, compositional practice. And Gabrieli's multi-choir music for brass exemplifies this very well. Let me turn some buttons here. Gabrieli, one scratchy moment, sorry about that. Now, the importance of Schütz's first and second visit are very important. In the second visit, we have a different situation emerging than in the first. Now, there are actually four handouts on this one sheet. So if you would please turn to the one that you see on the screen, it's called Transition from Italy to Germany, Early Baroque. There you can see where St. Mark's in Venice fits in, late 16th century, Gabrieli and so on. How they influence Schütz, they on the left-hand column. Thank you. Right. It is a shift from Italy to Germany. And then notice further to the right, Viadana, who was conservative and practical, but he busied himself with church music very much, and he wrote his 10 ecclesiastical pieces, so-called, for solo voice and basso continuo. He certainly exerted an influence, somewhat of an influence at least, on Monteverdi, and especially Monteverdi was influenced by the Camerata in Florence. The influence of Monteverdi, of course, then goes across over to Schütz as well. So you have a lot of relationships here. Now, each one of these lines, these connecting lines with the arrows, do not denote an influence of equal value, because some of these lines indicate a very strong influence and others, oh, somewhat of an influence, all right? So this is not ironclad. All diagrams fall down somewhere, rather. Then you can see that there is an influence that goes out from Schütz to Praetorius, and there's, of course, an influence of the music of Monteverdi on Praetorius, and we'll be singing some of his things in a moment. There was influence from Praetorius on Scheidt and on Schein, and there was also a direct relationship from Viadana on Schein. Now, this is a wonderful network of influences here. Now, the kind of music that Schütz very well might have heard when he went to Italy could well have sounded like this next little example. This by affective, saying, you know, dying for your sins, you know, for you, for pro nobis, for us. Now this is contemporary of Monteverdi, Busatti. One S and two T's. Solo vocal music. This is not Gabrieli, all right. Music, you know, you try to imagine listening to this kind of music in church on Sunday after you had heard only, you know, this blocky music of Gabrieli, so beautiful as it was, but quite a different mentality. Yes. Oh, this affective chromaticism was definitely in vogue. So if you're trying to say, died for our sins, you know, mori, mori, of course you would, to express the idea of dying, you would do something besides C major, you know. There would be, definitely, chromaticism would be in order. And this is a side of development in church music that is seldom dealt with, because I mean, if the overwhelming influence of the Gabrieli, Schütz, Buxtehude Bach development, I mean, whoever in the world gives a moment to Busatti, you know, and there is, if you're interested in an absolutely glorious recording, it's called Monteverdi's Contemporaries. It's an angel recording. Sorry, I don't have the number. and it's directed by David Monroe, M-U-N-R-O-W, David Monroe. And this is one of those little pieces on that recording, charmingly performed, Monteverdi's contemporaries. And just before we break for chapel this morning, let me just talk a little bit about the musical changes from the Renaissance to the Baroque, so that you'll understand a little bit how this transition came about from Gabrieli to Busatti. Right? Now, here are some of the main musical changes or differences. First of all, is the emerging of a polarity of the outer voices, which, of course, emphasizes accompanied melody. See, before you have all voices being sort of equally important, now you have the polarity of the top and bottom, the soprano and the bass, or the basso continuo line. Secondly, an expansion of range in both vocal and instrumental music. Thirdly, idiomatically composed music for specific voices and instruments. Now that was somewhat new as we enter the Baroque period. Up to that time, music, if you could hit the note, so to say, you could play it on a certain instrument. And more this it came about that you had specific kind of music and ranges for certain voices and instruments. Fourthly, the Baroque doctrine of the affections emerged, which is the teaching that music is dictated by text or a particular feeling. And the version of this doctrine of affections is somewhat different than the Renaissance doctrine of affections. Fifthly, an increased chromaticism. So you heard that definitely there in this little piece. Sixth, the basso continuo technique, known as thorough bass, figured bass, and so on, serves not only the free declamation during the recitatives, and you notice that in this little cantata that this man sang, that the continuo really helped him express what he was trying to express, and the basso continuo also supports the tonality of the accompaniment. This also relates to and well supports Baroque dance movements. That's also an area that's often neglected when we deal with church music. The Baroque dance movements, whether they be for instruments, voices, or both. And finally, the solo voice, that is, the individual singer, becomes more important than before. You don't just have choirs, you have the solo voice. And Viadana, in his 10 little pieces, he gave us some wonderful things there. But I'll just break off right there. And the first thing when you come back, I'll sing you a little example of Viadana. So.